Come in.
Excuse me, are you the horse astrologer?
Why, yes. I do look to the stars to determine the natures and afflictions of the equine race.
Excellent. I've got a very, very morose horse.
Oh my god.
I mean, look at that long face. And I can't figure out what's troubling him.
I think that's about as long as a horse's face usually is.
I woke up yesterday morning, his face was half as long. And look, he's been combing his mane at the side every day. And look at this, look at these CDs that I found in his stable.
All-time horse? Nay Day Parade?
And look at this, Panic at the Stable.
Taking Back Sunday?
Yes, there's a lot of CDs. You can move on now. We've made our point.
Wait, is that the new Lincoln Paddock CD? Lucky Horse. I've heard this one's really good.
Listen, I didn't come here to discuss with you my horse's musical tastes. I came here to get a horoscope reading.
Fine. All right, I'm just going to need a few details about your horse. To do the readings.
Okay.
The readings of the stars, which is what the horoscope is all about. So, what was your horse's date of birth?
I don't know.
Do you know the parentage of your horse?
I don't know.
Let me think. Any prior medical conditions?
I don't know.
Do you have any records or information about your horse? Any, like, documents? A birth certificate? Maybe like a, I don't know, some tax returns, social security number.
I'm a 13th century farmer, madam. I cannot read.
Okay, great. Thanks. I think that's all the information I need. Let me just get some charts out. Oh God, I hate this part so much. So according to my calculations, your horse's zodiac sign is a horse? Did they add that one recently? Oh, wait, sorry. Let me move this paperweight. Oh, that's an Aquarius.
Nope.
A Sagittarius.
That's the one.
Classic. Classic horse zodiac sign. So essentially, actually, do you mind just stepping into the side room with me? Leave the horse out there. He's got his headphones on.
Okay.
Essentially, your horse has borderline horsenality disorder.
My God. What am I supposed to do? So what does that mean?
I don't know. You think you become a horse astrologist by being good at astrology? You think this is what I wanted? All of my schoolmates are doing a human astrology for human health problems, okay? They're helping people with issues like cystic fibrosis and plantar fasciitis and chronic
IBS
fatigue and IBS. You think horses have zodiacs? You think that any of this is a horse, okay? Just give it some oats. Look, it's a horse. Just put it in the pasture or whatever it is people do with horses. I'm so tired. My wife left me for a human astrologer. I can never measure up.
You know, I'm starting to think you're not a real astrologer at all. I mean, look at that degree behind you. Where is that university anyway? Prester John University.
Hey,
do you even know your own zodiac sign?
Yeah, of course I do. I'm a Cancer.
Well, that explains it then. It's the conjunction of Mercury and Mars has made you prone to extreme mood swings and being bad at your job. Next week, as those heavy planets do shift apart, you will start to feel like less of a professional failure.
Ah, oh, it's all started to make sense. And will my wife come back?
No. Well, I'm glad you're starting to feel better about things, but you've been absolutely no use to me. I'm so disappointed in this interaction that I'm going to go home and listen to the new Fallout Horse.
The feast is o'er. Now brimming wine in lordly cup is he who shine before each eager guest. And silence fills the crowded hall, as deep as when the herald's call thrills in the loyal breast.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, my satellite.
Bum, bum. bum 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 bum.
If you couldn't guess from that brief musical interlude and our cold open, we are talking all about space, the stars, and the cosmos in the medieval conception.
Yeah, what was going on up there? What did they think Earth was? What did they think space was? What did they think stars were?
And the answer is, well, it will all be revealed in this episode of the podcast, so listen on. And so we'll be talking a bit about what medieval people thought the universe looked like on kind of like a structural level, what they thought it was actually made out of, because they had lots of ideas about that, the actual composition of the universe, and also about how medieval people engaged with this on an intellectual level, how they looked at the stars, what they used astronomy and astrology, to the extent that those were different things in the Middle Ages for, and much, much more. So I think we should just dive right in.
Let's get in our rocket ship and let's go on an interstellar journey.
Yes. So, despite the fact that people in the Middle Ages believed that the Earth was flat.
And we stop. Okay. Pause here. We're doing this. Finally. We're addressing it. And we're addressing it sincerely, not in a jokey way. Because at a certain point, you do need to engage seriously with this. Because it's one of the most pervasive myths about the Middle Ages. Somehow we didn't do it in our, like, second, like, myth-busting episode.
You're right. Yeah, it is strange. I think more people know that this one is fake than, say, for instance, witch trials. But yeah, I think it's still worth...
I totally disagree.
Yeah, you know what? You might be right. Well, what we're talking about specifically is the idea that people in the Middle Ages thought the Earth was flat.
Yeah. And before I get into explaining why that's problematic, I need to do, a bit of pedantry. I'm sure there was somebody in Lancashire who was like, you know, working the land and said to his mate, "No, I think about Earth, mate. It's flat, innit?" I'm sure some people thought that because, you know, information is distributed differently back then. But the idea that like a learned intellectual person would believe the Earth was flat, we have no evidence of that. No evidence that we should take remotely seriously.
Yeah.
And to kick us off, I have a quote that makes this point in excruciating detail, right? And this is from the Venerable Bede, right? The 7th century Anglo-Saxon monk and sort of granddaddy of old English learning and culture. And I'm choosing the Venerable Bede because this is not some Italian Renaissance pervert who pedants can come up at me and say, "Well, he's technically not medieval because he's from the Renaissance. That's kind of modern." Sorry, I don't know why I did that person as a beetle. Anyway, so the Venerable Bede says, "The reason why the same days are of unequal length is the roundness of the earth. For not without reason is it called the orb of the world on the pages of holy scripture and of ordinary literature. It is in fact a sphere set in the middle of the whole universe. It is not merely circular like a shield, or spread out like a wheel, but resembles more a ball, being equally round in all directions."
Equally round in all directions is, yeah.
That's how I feel after Thanksgiving.
Which is when we're recording this, yes. Fun fact.
We are recording this the day after Thanksgiving.
Yes, exactly. And obviously, the knowledge that the Earth is spherical goes back much earlier than that. It's the ancient Greeks who established the spherical shape of the Earth. And that is not really challenged until nowadays.
Yeah.
And actually, spheres, I think, will very much be the theme of today's episode, because the medieval understanding of what the universe looked like was very much rooted in ideas of these spherical bodies in the heavens, in some ways similar to, but in some ways very different to how we think of the cosmos today.
Yeah, and I want to stay for a second with the Earth as a sphere, because there's a couple of fun, it's not just Bede who says this, we have quite a lot of sort of cultural ephemera that suggests that the idea of the Earth being round is just an accepted fact.
Yeah.
So, for example, we have drawings from things like the Tiberius Psalter, which is from the 11th century, which shows God creating the earth holding a compass. Now, that is something that you use to draw a circle. And that is not a reference that makes sense unless the reader infers that the earth is round.
Well, it could just be a disc, right? Like, you can't draw a sphere with a compass.
No, I'm not doing this. We're not doing this. We also have, from Dante's Divine Comedy, we also have references to time zones, where he's like, yeah, it's this time in Egypt and this time in India.
Yeah.
Which is not something that, which is, again, not something that you can infer from, or sorry, that's something you can observe empirically in a world before instant communication and fast long-distance travel. It's something that you kind of have to divine from first principles. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, you know. When the sun is on one side of Earth, it is facing that side of Earth and not other side of Earth. It's a pretty reasonable conclusion. And those are just the Christians as well, because in the Muslim world, it was also widely accepted that the Earth was round. And we have lots of examples of Islamic scholars being commissioned by caliphs and sultans to figure out how big Earth is, figure out its circumference, and they usually get it within like 10% accuracy, which is pretty good. Basically, you do it by sighting the sun in two separate locations, and then you use just trigonometry to figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Eratosthenes calculated the circumference of the Earth in around, I think, 300 BC or thereabouts with a similar margin of error. So, yeah. And I think one of the themes that we'll come back to a few times in this episode is the fact that despite people working with these extremely primitive tools, they were actually able to infer a great deal of information about the cosmos. Now, they were also able to come up with all sorts of absolutely insane things that weren't true in the slightest, but more on that later.
Well, we can do more on that now.
True.
Because that was the next thing that I want to talk about is Columbus. Because there is a popular myth, which I think, to be fair, people have kind of cottoned on to the fact this isn't true, but it still shows up embarrassingly often in, like, popular science history. The idea that Columbus sailed to America because he was the only person who understood that the Earth was round and could be circumnavigated. Which is obviously nonsense on the sort of, just on the kind of empirical level of, like, sailing to America doesn't prove that the Earth is round. It just proves that there's more Earth.
Yeah.
He never got to Asia. Anyway, so yeah, the idea is that Columbus, the brave, intrepid scholar, faced opposition in court for his grand venture to India because everybody said, oh, you'll just fall off the edge of the world. And Columbus did face opposition from conventional wisdom in court, but not about the shape of the world, about its size. Because his entire argument is, nah, mate, Earth 25% smaller than you think it is.
Yeah, so by this point, the circumference of the Earth was well established and fairly accurate. And actually, as a little bit of a tangent, I almost feel like part of the reason why people think that medieval people had this conception of the world as flat is because we don't see a lot of globes or representations of the Earth that indicate that it's a sphere, really during that time period. But I think what's important to point out is people did know the Earth was spherical, and they thought that the area between Europe and Asia, where we now know the Americas to be, was this vast ocean. And actually, if you think about how big that ocean would be, I think it was in people's minds effectively like the edge of the world. Like, there was no way to traverse that.
Yeah.
And so there was no point in, like, thinking about the Earth except as this sort of triumvirate of continents, Asia, Europe, and Africa.
Well, I think that there's that. And then there's just the fact that actually, the reason why we use things like the Mercator projection and maps that are just structurally wrong is that it's very hard to represent three-dimensional space on two dimensions.
Yeah, and until you're working with much more complex navigational techniques than they had, then actually an accurate map doesn't really get you anywhere. And that's why you get a lot of medieval maps that are like, walk to Canterbury and then ask them how to get to Kent. And then walk once you do that, ask them how to get to Dover.
That's why all the big medieval maps are just like a bunch of squiggles.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I mentioned this before we started recording, Aaron, but I read an interesting theory that probably holds absolutely no water, but has completely got me fixated on it, that because people thought that there was just this massive ocean, Columbus's proposal, even though he did propose that the Earth was smaller than most people thought, the scale of this journey, like if you imagine setting sail from Iberia, sailing across the Atlantic Ocean, and then across a tract of water the same size as America, and then across the Pacific Ocean, mm-hmm. which is about that big all over again. Even like if you reduce the size of that journey by like 50%, it's like it's basically an impossible journey.
Yeah.
And so I read some really interesting theories that Columbus might have had some sort of suspicion that there might be land, even if it was just like islands or sort of interstitial land masses that he could use to replenish and refresh on his way to Asia. So, but I don't really endorse that on like an intellectual level. I need to look into it more, but it was something that I found really interesting as a concept.
Maybe he'd been getting really into some skaldic poetry.
Well, because he was just so insistent that the earth was smaller than it actually is. And like so insistent because he wanted to sail across this ocean. And like even it's like, mate, you're going to die either way. Like how are you this hung up on, I don't know, this... Yeah, this incorrect calculation.
Well, I mean, part of the reason is that he's a maniac.
Well, he's just extraordinarily greedy.
Yeah,
I think that's the main thing. He wanted to be, but then this is an episode for another episode. But he wanted to be that guy, and unfortunately he became that guy. Yeah,
he was that guy to the great detriment of millions upon millions of people.
Yep.
I mean, that's the thing about Columbus that I find endlessly interesting, is that even by, people are like, oh, don't judge some historical character by the standards of the time. Okay, let's judge him by the standards of his time. He got fired from being governor of the colony of Hispaniola for being too cruel to the indigenous people and just generally incompetent. Do you know how incompetent and cruel you have to be to get fired from that job in the Spanish Empire? The most ludicrously evil of all the New World empires?
Yeah.
So we've established, I think, that two things about the medieval understanding of the cosmos, right? Earth round and Earth about as big as it actually is. And I should say that these ideas are broadly shared among the sort of the three Abrahamic faiths. Like, you know, Jews, Muslims, and Christians are all broadly, if you pardon the pun, singing from the same hymn sheet on this. Now we've spent enough time thinking about Earth, let's get in our rocket ship and let's start going up into space.
Whoop whoop.
One of the things that is very important to note about the medieval understanding about space is that they are drawing on a lot of ideas, and I say drawing pretty much directly all of their models about how the universe works from classical sources, and from classical Greek sources in particular. Now, the ancient Greeks spent a lot of time thinking about space and the cosmos and the universe. I mean, the word cosmos, for God's sake. And not all of that was science as well. This is a tangent, but I just want to talk about it because I'm not going to get another opportunity to talk about it on the podcast. One of my favorite little sidebars from classical history is a work of satire by the Syrian author Lucian of Samosata, which is arguably the first ever sci-fi story. It's a text called A True Story, which is a great name for sci-fi, and it's all about this band of Greek adventurers who get swept out to sea and then carried up out of the atmosphere and into outer space. And it's this amazing story of them getting swept up in this interplanetary war between the kingdom of the sun and the kingdom of the moon, and it ends with this huge battle where civilizations from all over from stars all over the universe are coming together for this great battle. There's talking spiders, people riding giant ants. It's incredible. It's very Dune.
Yes, it's a lot like a lot of intellectual properties, to be honest.
Well, it's the first space opera.
It's very Dune, it's very Avatar, it's very Fern Gully in a sense.
It's very Gregor the Overlander.
Yes, exactly.
Shout out
yes.
to a very specific type of person who just flipped their shit.
Yeah. It's like very Dairy Girls, because you have that conflict, but that violent conflict between two organizations.
Yeah. That's the moon people for you. fucking savages.
Oh God.
I'm not doing her accent for that joke.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
I respect that show too much.
I can give it a go if you want.
Please.
No. Actually.
This can go in the outtakes.
No, I can't do it. If I was like in the flow and we weren't on air or if we weren't recording, I probably could bust out like a 2 out of 10 Northern Irish accent.
I can do a really good Northern Irish, but only like a really staunch guy.
Yeah, well, that's
like the
thing,
most
yeah.
Protestant guy.
And it's not, well, yeah. I there was a time when I could do like a pretty good sort of generic Belfast guy. But that was like when I was friends with more Belfast guys.
Never.
Like that. They do sound like that, yeah.
It's just a glorified Ian Paisley. Anyway, so that was a tangent. Go and read a true story. It definitely happened. It's real.
Right. So, yeah, so medieval people are getting a lot of information from classical sources. They're getting a lot of information from sources from the Arabic world as well. And I am a bit careful not to say Muslim sources per se, because you also have to acknowledge the contributions made by Jews and Zoroastrians as well, both in the Arabic world and in Europe. Well, Zoroastrians less in Europe, to be honest.
Yeah, they never really came over.
No, yeah.
Some of them ended up in India, interestingly.
Yeah. But yeah, I think education in the Middle Ages and education about astronomy and astrology and space is, I think, a really interesting example of this multi-faith collaboration, because you have a lot, especially beginning in like the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries onwards, you get a lot of transmission of information between the Arabic world and Europe. A lot of those Arabic sources are translations of ancient Greek texts as well. So a lot of those are ultimately classical sources too, but they've been often improved upon and added to by the Arabic scholars.
Yes, and I should say, commented on and improved on by not just Muslim scholars as well, but also Christian and Jewish and Zoroastrian scholars living in the Arabic world.
Yes, and also in, I would say, Spain as well, and Iberia. Mm-hmm. Toledo is a big center of translation, and a lot of Jewish scholars worked in translation there as well. And so I think the most important of all of the concepts we're going to be talking about, the sort of ideological or theoretical backbone of medieval cosmology, is spheres.
Yes, it's spheres all the way down, baby.
Yes, all the way up and all the way down. And this is an ancient idea that persists long, even past the Middle Ages, the cosmic spheres. And even now, it's kind of a powerful symbolic representation of the universe. But it was not just symbolic, it was very real in the medieval eye.
So the ancient Greeks and medieval people, they were right about Earth round, but they were not right about Earth is the center of the universe. Because the model that the medieval people inherit from the ancient world is a geocentric one, right? The Earth is the center of the universe, and the sun, the moon, the planets, and the stars orbit around them. Now, the way that that works mechanically is, like we said, a system of interlocking spheres. Think of it like a kind of Russian doll. So at the center, the little tiny fucked up looking Russian doll is Earth. And then around that, and I'm going to be general here because there is not an agreement about how many spheres there are in this system and what's in them and what order. So I'm going to get this wrong. Don't write in. Then you have an invisible sphere around the Earth that carries the moon around the Earth. Then you have an invisible sphere around that then carries the sun. And then you have spheres around that carry the planets. And then you have the weirdest of spheres, the primum mobile, or the prime mover, which is a sphere that moves all the other spheres. So it's this very, it's this kind of clockwork universe where all these spheres that carry these celestial bodies are being moved around by the prime mover. And the Abrahamic faiths improve on that and they say, well, where's God in all this? And the answer is he's outside of the prima mobile. He is directing all of it from heaven, which is outside of these spheres.
He's the unmoved mover.
Yes.
I think it's also really, really important to stress that during the Middle Ages, debate about the nature of the cosmos was ongoing, it was frequent, it was intense, and it was really important. And this is an idea we've touched on before, but even though all of these discussions about celestial spheres and divine clockwork might sound a bit abstract and a little bit difficult to sort of like sink your teeth into and a little bit, you know, of an odd thing to have these fierce arguments about, you have to remember, again, these are arguments about how the universe was created by God. And thus, these are arguments about the purpose of the universe. Mm-hmm. And so when everything has a divine purpose, because remember, the cosmos is not just, is not accidentally the way that it is. It's created. In fact, I believe the word cosmos means something like divine order. So everything is ordered. Everything is hierarchical. And that's not an idea that originates in the Middle Ages, but it is one that they really latch onto in the Middle Ages. Then these are existential questions and they have implications for life on Earth as well.
Well, it's like, you know, it's in much the same way that the debate about evolution in the 19th century was so disruptive and controversial. Of course, questions about the nature of the universe are existential. They are literally, it's the most literally existential thing you can have.
Yeah, exactly. And so some of the debates that go on, for instance, there are debates about how many spheres there are. I think the ancient Greeks start out with a ridiculously high number, like 42 or something. And then by the time we get to the Middle Ages, the Arabic philosophers have whittled it down and said there's the same number of spheres that there are planets. So I believe that's usually either 7 or 8. Remember, the sun is also a planet in this case.
Yeah, some people add a sphere that carries the stellarium, so just all the stars that you see in the night sky. Which
yeah.
Which are different things from the sun.
Yep. And as well, by the time we get on to the High Middle Ages, there are also ideas about the nature of these spheres, what they're made out of. I mean, that also goes back to the classical world. They're often agreed upon to be made out of something invisible and ethereal, literally sort of an ether. And there's also divisions. And again, the hierarchy of the spheres and of Earth in relation to the cosmos is very important because Earth is at the center. So humans are at the center of the universe, but they're also the lowest down. And so...
And therefore the furthest from God.
Yes, exactly. And so there's an idea that was articulated by someone who I'll be talking about a bit in this episode, I believe 13th century bishop named Robert Grosseteste. And his idea was that the cosmos was also divided into two domains, the sublunary and the superlunary. The idea was that the sublunary domain, so basically there's a boundary created by the moon and everything below it is mutable and changeable. And that explains things like the weather and the changing sort of nature of life on Earth. But then once you get beyond the moon, things are fixed, and so they rotate in the sky, they have orbits and divine movement, but they do not change. And this is also an interesting idea because by necessity it means that things like comets and meteors and supernovas sort of have to be like meteorological phenomena. In fact, meteorology, the study of the weather, is kind of in the name, isn't it? And so it was really tied to this idea that, like, life on Earth is imperfect. It's material. It is, you know, literally earthly.
I think it speaks to a deeper truth, which is this model of the universe represents a broader division of life into the sort of the earthly domain and the cosmic spiritual domain.
I have a few things to say about, like, things that this guy said about the cosmos that were, like, strangely sort of accurate.
Hit me. Let's get some stuff right by accident.
I don't know if it was by accident, you know. I mean, Robert Grosseteste was, a very influential scientist, much more so than we give him credit for. And, yeah, maybe a bit of this is accidental, but he had a lot of conceptions. I mean, he wrote extensively on spheres, on light, on creation. And in particular, one thing that really struck me was reading about his description of the creation of the universe. I don't know if you read about this.
No, I did not.
It's really interesting.
I was too busy thinking about spheres.
So he describes the creation, the process of the creation of the universe, which is, of course, conducted by God. But he describes sort of what this looks like on an actual material level. And he says that it starts off with this incredibly dense concentration of matter.
Oh my God.
That then explodes outwards and sort of crystallizes in like successive layers. And so it's really, really interesting.
Oh my God. That's actually a bit freaky.
It is a bit terrifying, but then I think, you know, it, yeah, well, yeah, that's really all there is to say to it. And I think that's the point where it's kind of hard to say, is that accidental? Or, you know, would we think of the creation of the universe in a similar way? Have we come at it from a completely different angle to him?
I think I'd have to see his working to figure that out.
Yeah, and he describes basically everything that happens in the universe in terms of interactions between energy and matter. So that's also, I would say, very sort of much more advanced than we often give medieval science credit for. His writings on light as well. So he writes about light. He writes about optics. He says optics, when well understood, shows us how we may make things a very long distance off appear as if placed very close, and large near things appear very small. And he talks about how he writes extensively about how lenses work, and about how light essentially works. I mean, some of his diagrams are extremely complex. And he also distills everything down to mathematics. So he says that everything can be described mathematically, which is also, I think, something that a lot of modern forms of science you basically lead back to.
Well, certainly physics.
Yes, exactly. And so he basically is one of the first people to put to paper this idea that I think has been echoed much more recently, that math is sort of the language with which the universe is written. I think to give sort of an idea of how all of these notions evolved would be a little bit, probably lead to something a little bit too long-winded, but I really wanted to emphasize, and I really do recommend that you go and check out Robert Grosseteste's The Hexameron. I think you can probably pirate a copy online. That's what I did. there are English translations out there, but hopefully these little extracts have given you a sense for the fact that people were not just thinking about the stars as like, oh, and the cosmos is, oh, it's up there and God made it. They were thinking very much about, you know, the interactions and the continuity between Earth and the cosmos and the actual processes behind these things. However, one thing that, just to temper sort of any awe for Robert Grosseteste's thinking that I may have created with a little bit of skepticism, one thing that he writes about as well is the size of the universe.
Yay.
In particular, he says, well, Aristotle wrote that time and space are infinite. And what a moron that guy was. Everybody knows the world was created at the beginning of time by God, and that the universe, of course, is finite. And he has a really good quote about
those are that's closer to the accepted scientific consensus than Aristotle.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that is, I mean, that
the
is
science,
fair.
Scientists would, most people accept the universe is a finite space.
Well, then
And it had an origin point.
Then here you go. I wanted to read this quote. So he says, "You should be aware that what led the ancients astray into claiming that the world had no beginning was above all a false use of the imagination. This made them imagine before any given time, another time, just as the fantasy imagines a place outside any given place and a space outside any given space, and so on to infinity. To cleanse oneself of this error, then, one can only cleanse the affection of one's mind of its love of temporal things, so the glance of the mind, untouched by images, can go beyond time and grasp the simplicity of eternity, in which there is no extension of before and after, and from which all time and every before and every after proceed.
No, I okay. I am going to defend him here because I think that is basically true. I know this is going to be a tangent, but guess what? This is the Aaron and Olivia tangent hour. It always has been. I think it is really difficult to imagine time as finite and the universe as having a definitive beginning beyond, before which there was nothing and after which there will be nothing. I'm reminded of, and I think that's not only like conceptually hard, I think it's psychologically and emotionally hard. It reminds me of another piece of science fiction, a more recent piece of science fiction, which I also really enjoy, which is the book Death's End, which is the third book in the Three-Body Problem series, which, read it, it's weird, it's very dense, it's all very wooden, but it's good. If you like hard sci-fi, it's a good time. Anyway, the point about the book, the last kind of third of this incredibly long book is kind of about reaching the end of the universe and the end of time. And it's about, and I'm not going to spoil it, I'm going to keep this all abstract because you should read it, but it's about kind of accepting the fact that there, and the characters and the reader having to accept the fact that no, there is a point beyond which nothing survives. And you're not going, you have to let go of this fantasy that things can go on forever. And reading the book, I found that objectionable. As a reader, I was like, no, but there has to be a, there has to be a continuity, but no, it's the end of the universe.
Yeah, no, that's fair. We think about the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment in the 18th and 17th centuries as being when science sort of fully took form in the modern sense, and that is definitely true. And that, I think, has to do a lot with the technological advancements, because people in the Middle Ages, like Robert Gross attests, did not have the ability to actually know very well what was out there physically. And so that's why we still have these descriptions of these, you know, crazy spheres and whatnot. But I think what his writings do go to show you is that philosophically, and he did also, and medieval scholars as well, wrote about the scientific process and about, you know, the importance of drawing conclusions based on judgments. And I think as well, these writings about the cosmos show that philosophically people were already grappling with a lot of the issues that we're grappling with now. I mean, infinity and the infinite or not infinite size of the universe is something that I think everybody has sat there and gone through that same process that he describes of thinking, oh, but then there could be something bigger, but then what's bigger than that and what's bigger than that? And so I think people were already kind of scraping at the ceiling of the universe, so to speak. Yeah, and to just say one more thing on Robert Gross' test, which is that what he describes as being the issue with these ancient philosophers and the issue with their line of thinking is fundamentally sort of a misalignment of the imagination with what the universe truly is. And so despite the emphasis that these medieval philosophers and scientists put on empirical judgment and observation when it came to science, I think this still does go to show you that when it came to these more abstract philosophical matters, the backbone of it was still very much that you should be thinking in line with the divine ordering and the divine creation of the universe, and that you need to sort of keep that at the center of your practice.
Absolutely, because I think the thing to remember about Robert is that he's a bishop.
Yes.
He's a scientist, but he's also a bishop. And there is this kind of, there's this interesting, not tension, because I don't think they would have thought about this as a tension, but this duality in the way that people like him are talking and writing about the universe, which is, yeah, like the on the one hand, the universe as this kind of material, empirically observable thing, and then the other thing is the universe as this divinely ordered thing. And I think there's no better kind of concept that unifies those two things, that brings them together, than the idea of the music of the spheres, which is such a, is a concept that has a lot of roots in modern science fiction, but its real origin point is is classical philosophy and classical astronomy. So I'm going to pull here from Cicero and his work, The Dream of Scipio, where he describes what the music of the spheres is, which is essentially the idea that the movement of these cosmic spheres, whatever they're made of, creates this sound, which is this harmonic music, which human ears can't detect, because if we did, we would flip out. To quote, "So great is the sound of the whole universe." That's how Cicero sounds in my head.
Yeah.
Actually, no, I think he's a bit readier. Let me think.
He is. I mean, his name means garbanzo bean, so you can't play him too straight.
So great is the sound of the whole universe, turning at the highest speed, that the ears of man cannot catch it, just as you cannot look straight at the sun, and as your sense of sight is overpowered by its beams. So that's a very sci-fi idea that, like, the planets make a noise that is too devastating for human ears. I mean, we get a little bit of references in culture that suggest that the human ear can't hear it, but the soul can. So when Dante is ascending the spheres in Paradiso, he can hear it. But when he passes Saturn, the sound becomes so unbearably overwhelming, because the closer you get to God, the louder the noise is. Anyway, so the reason why I think that the music of the spheres is so important is because, what is music? It is something that is produced. It's a physical sensation that we hear through physical processes, and it's produced by physical processes, but it's also ordered. It is also set by an intelligence. At least good music, anyway.
Yeah.
Whatever music you don't like isn't that.
Yeah, absolutely. And music was very important in medieval philosophy and education. So if you were studying at a medieval university, you would be taught the quadrivium, which were the four kind of main subjects of the medieval educational doctrine. And the subjects of the quadrivium were arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. And crucially, all of these subjects were considered to be related, although they were hierarchical as well, and astronomy was often placed at the top.
Space is cool.
Yeah, but I think it's also really important to point out that the Middle Ages were the genesis of a lot of modern music theory. I mean, this is a real sort of mind melter to me, but before the Middle Ages, we have no idea what music sounded like. We know what instruments they had, and we know some things they thought about music, but they did not write down music in a systematic way.
Which means that it is theoretically possible that the Beatles didn't actually write their own music. They just found some old papyrus.
Time travelers.
They found some old papyrus scrolls.
No, crucially, they didn't. There are no old papyrus
no,
scrolls.
No, that's right. Sorry. Yeah, no. They're times. We're time travelers, Ringo. We've come from the future.
Yes, this song is called Hey Judea.
Get in my yellow boat.
Anyways. My point being that in the Middle Ages, people really began to think systematically about music and about modes and rhythms and form in the way that these could be described and expressed mathematically. And so music was seen as a sort of high form of science.
The science of bangers.
Yes, I mean, basically. And again, like, this is not, I don't think, separate to modern conceptions of how acoustics are generated mathematically and the physical study of that, because people were also thinking about sound on a mathematical level. And so, anyways, I won't get into all of that, but I think it's important to, again, note that, like, mathematics, astronomy, and music were, like, the holy educational trinity.
And they interact, and I think, as we've seen, they interacted with each other extensively.
Yeah.
What I think we've done so far is, I think, represented these as abstract ideas, but I also want to think a little bit about what they kind of felt like. And one of my favorite medieval cultural depictions of the universe is from the end of one of Chaucer's lesser-known poems. This is not the Canterbury Tales. Troilus and Cressida. And so at the end of the poem, Troilus, a Trojan soldier, dies in battle, and Chaucer writes this really remarkable description of his spirit ascending towards heaven and leaving earth. And when he was slain in this manner, his light ghost full blissfully went up to the hollowness of the eighth sphere, leaving behind every element. And there he saw, clear in his ascent, the wandering planets, hearing harmony in sounds full of heavenly melody. I love that. It's so sci-fi. It's so cool. But there's more. Because that quote is super interesting. But what's even more interesting to me is the next stanza. Because as Troilus's spirit is ascending and he's hearing the music of the spheres, he looks down and sees Earth. And I'm just going to read this. And down from there he spies this little spot of Earth that with the sea is embraced, and begins to despise this wretched world, and hold it in vanity compared with the true felicity that is heaven above. And at the last, down where he was slain, his gaze is cast. Now that is an incredible image. That is the blue marble. That is the famous image of the Earth from space. Transplanted, you know, the better part of a millennium before it could actually be captured in image. It's being depicted here in much the same way as this kind of, it's crazy.
Yeah. It is. I think it's one of those things that, like, I mean, in general, all of this is, like, if, like me, you're not that smart, you just can't think about it too hard because it starts getting so stressful. But then, like, yeah, thinking about, I don't know, the waves of the harmonics that they studied, because they studied a lot of harmonics in, like, their music theory, and the ways that, like, planetal orbits can be described by these, like, sinusoidal waveforms that are also, like, the harmonics. I mean, because we use, like, words like harmonics nowadays in modern physics to refer to planetary motion. And, like, that's basically, yeah, I don't know.
Well, I wanna carry on this this connection between modern physics and space exploration and space and the study of space and that poem. Because you may have noticed an interesting theme that came out in that excerpt, which is the idea of this wretched world and looking down at it and despising it, because that is so utterly different from the way that basically everybody who goes to space describes that experience. So I have a couple of quotes here from people who've been to space. So I've got one here from Lauren Acton, who, shout out to Lauren Acton, like my co-host, a real life Montanan.
Yes.
They sent a Montanan to space.
And somehow he actually wanted to come back.
To Montana. So he says, looking outward to the blackness of space, sprinkled with the glory of a universe of lights, I saw majesty, but no welcome. Below was a welcoming planet. There, contained in the thin, moving, incredibly fragile shell of the biosphere, is everything that is dear to you, all the human drama and comedy. That's where life is. That's where all the good stuff is. And I have another quote, actually, from a Soviet cosmonaut, Alexei Leonov, who was the first spacewalker, who describes the Earth when he looked at it. The Earth was small, light blue, and so touchingly alone, our home that must be defended like a holy relic. So here in both of those quotes, and in a lot of other sort of quotes, because I did a lot of reading of, like, people who had been to space, and I picked those two because I felt like they made a really good contrast to Chaucer, in that the idea that the good stuff is on Earth and the Earth is holy is something that seems to be a visceral, almost physical reaction that people have when they actually see this. But the medieval mind, when constructing that image from whole cloth without any sort of empirical experience of it, is carrying all of these assumptions about the Earth being this wretched place that you have to sort of survive to get to the good stuff. And so the image is fated with such a different reaction.
Yeah, because they're on their way somewhere better.
Yeah.
I think people who have been to space realize, like, it's not that much out there.
You're nothing. There's not that much to do.
Mom, I'm bored. Can we go home?
Yes, it'll take 52 days.
Yep.
So, there is an extra level of complexity to the medieval model of the universe, which is the idea that the movement of these celestial bodies can have an impact on human events. Which I think, given the stuff that we've already outlined in this episode, is not too big a leap. Now, this study, this science, is still with us today, and it goes by the name of...
astrology!
That's right.
Now again, this wasn't invented in the Middle Ages, but this idea of the ordered universe fit in so well with the idea of in God's intelligent creation. And so even though we might think of astrology today as being somewhat incompatible with Christianity, it was not the case in the Middle Ages at all. And in fact, this was something that went on even beyond the Middle Ages, the Christian interest in astrology.
Yeah. I mean, the Western astrological model with, like, you know, the 12 signs, one of them's a crab and one of them's two dudes and so on. This comes from ancient Babylon and then was appropriated by Hellenistic culture when Babylon was conquered by Alexander the Great. And then the Islamic world picked this up when they conquered the sort of the Middle East in the early Middle Ages. And my God, Islamic scholarship got very into this. The caliphs absolutely loved astrology. They enthusiastically sponsored the translation of the classical Greek texts, the classical Greek scientific texts on astrology into Arabic.
Yes, and actually I believe it was a Muslim philosopher who first described the distinction between astrology and astronomy. So if I understand this correctly, actually before this, they weren't really perceived as different fields at all. There was a continuity between the planets themselves and the celestial bodies and the effects that they had on Earth. But I believe it was Avicenna, so he was a 10th, 11th century Muslim scientist, and he was the one who put this in more formal terms, so saying astronomy is the study of the planets themselves and of the heavenly bodies, and astrology is the effects, the study of the effects that those heavenly bodies will have on Earth and on specific terrestrial affairs.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about medieval Islamic astrology is that it did not, the Hellenistic tradition that they sort of picked up did not survive unchanged. So a lot of Islamic astrologers actually synthesized like classical astrology with pre-Islamic forms of divination. And so a lot of these sort of esoterica associated with astrology doesn't come from the Greeks, it comes from pre-Islamic Arabia. And that is, I think, well summarized in an anecdote that I love about the life of Abu Masar al-Balkhi, who was one of the sort of preeminent Persian astrologers in the Middle Ages. So the Middle East in this period, because astrology is kicking off in a big way, is not just full of legitimate professional academic astrologers like Abu Masar. It's also full of charlatans, chancers, slippin' Jimmy types. And there's one story about Abu Masar where he's on his way to do the fortune of an imprisoned man. And on his way to work, Abu Masar sees a fraud in the street trying to draw people in and get him to pay them to read their fortune. And he knows, he can tell, as a true professional, this guy's full of it. So he, you know, he decides to mess with him a bit. He goes up to the fake astrologer and he says, you know, okay, tell me what I'm going to do today. And the fake astrologer says, well, actually, you're going to look into the affairs of a prisoner, but that when you get there, the prisoner will be freed. And Abu Masar is like, well, that was weird. And he goes to meet with the prisoner and he finds out that the prisoner has been freed. So he freaks out, and he reportedly says one of my favorite quotes of all time: "If I do not know how this charlatan predicted correctly, I will lose my mind, tear up my books, and believe in the falsehood of astrology." So he rushes to find the fraudster and he asks him, how do you do it? How did you do it? And the fraudster says, I'm going to be real with you, man. I don't know anything about astrology.
He's like, I don't even know enough to concoct a convincing explanation.
He actually says, and I quote here, I lie and deceive women, and I place in front of me this dustboard, this astrolabe, and this ephemeris. And so sort of he pretends to be performing astrology, but in fact he's using under the table, he's using traditional Arabic divination to figure it out. Now we get a couple of tidbits from this story, which I love. One, the coexistence of traditional Arabian divination and Hellenistic astrology. And two, the fact that women are disproportionately into astrology. Even in early medieval Persia. It's always been like this. I was saying to Olivia before the show that my belief in astrology varies hour by hour and is directly proportional to my proximity to a beautiful woman who wants to talk to me about astrology.
And if you're thinking, oh, well, medieval Christians, how could they accept astrology fully? Because it's this practice that seeks, in many ways, to sort of create some kind of predeterminism or to express some kind of predeterminism of people or actions or movements. And surely people shouldn't be trying to dabble in that type of thing. And the answer is, well, yeah, a lot of medieval Christians and medieval people in general hated astrology and they thought it was heretical and they thought it was this gross human transgression into the divine, sort of, you know, stepping on God's toes, basically.
And another important bit of context is that astrology really has a boom in the late Middle Ages when, at kind of the same time that necromancy does, if you remember the witches episode, because this version of astrology comes over from the Islamic world as part of that same package of science, but also of demonology. And so there are a lot of reasons for learned Christians to be heavily skeptical of the whole enterprise.
Yeah, and I was actually about to bring up the episode where we talked about witches, because I think another important thing to draw out there is that, like a lot of forms of magic in the Middle Ages, the fact that it was in many ways frowned upon did not keep people from practicing it. For instance, to deceive beautiful women, which we also had in the witchcraft episode with the deacon or someone who's finding women's linen and then admitting to improper actions with them. And it's not stopping people, especially in positions of power, from trying to exploit these things. So having a court astrologer was a big deal in the Middle Ages. Christine de Pizan's father was one. Because it could be really good to have a guy who could look at the stars or look at their charts and say, now is probably a good time to go to war.
And also, like, as we've been drawing out throughout this episode, astrology is deeply connected to the sciences. So, like, if we cast our minds all the way back to the episode about sieges and the episode about Conrad Kaiser, what's the most famous image from his great work, The Bella Fortis? It's of Alexander the Great holding a rocket that has an astrological sign on it.
Yes.
I mean, you couldn't ask for a better representation of the point. Thank you, Conrad.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And so there was in general seen as a bit of a distinction between okay and not okay things to try to do with astrology. And so to try to predict the future would be basically a massive violation of Christian doctrine, especially the doctrine of free will. And so Augustine, for instance, really didn't like astrology because of that. But then I think other church officials throughout the Middle Ages were a little bit softer on using astrology in a sort of way that proposed a less direct kind of cause and effect relationship. For instance, using astrology to decide what a good day would be to commence a new endeavor, to build something, to administer a medical treatment, or to try to determine the source of a medical ailment. So things like that were, I think, much more acceptable in the mainstream. And so you might be asking yourself, well, what did all of this astrology actually look like? Because right now in the modern era, I would say most people's knowledge of astrology basically extends to their star sign. So for instance, Aaron, you're a Leo, so that means, what, is that one of the, you're like a drama queen, right?
Yeah, I'm a swaggering theatrical dipshit.
Yeah, I'm a Virgo, which means I'm a stone cold bitch.
You're a Virgo, which means you haven't had sex. Another, more things that aren't...
Oh, maybe there is something to this astrology business. So in particular, I think medical astrology was somewhere where astrology really, really flourished. And so people did have the same 12 zodiac signs, and those signs were very much thought to influence your personality in the same way. But also medieval astrologers were constantly sort of looking to the stars to see what types of actions might be auspicious, what types of things that might the universe be causing in the moment. And so a big one, for instance, was that zodiac signs were associated with different parts of the body in medicine. So if you Google medieval zodiac man, you'll see these great diagrams of human bodies, and there's a different zodiac sign basically floating over different parts of the body. Yeah, you look it up.
Well, that's upsetting.
Yeah, and so we've got Aries, which is associated with the head. And so if you have... for instance, issues with your eyes, or if you have a headache, then, or chronic head problems, then you might want to administer treatments in particular in the month of Aries. Or you might say this has been caused by the movement of a particular planet through the constellation of Aries, because all of the planets also have associations. Taurus associated with your neck.
I really want, just to be clear, I really want people to pull up this image. So they can really connect with this, because I'm looking right now at a representation of a 15th century Welsh manuscript, and it is just like there is just a sheep sitting on his head.
Yeah, and so he's
very whimsical.
He's got Gemini on the shoulders. Leo is your chest. No, Cancer is your chest. Leo is like your sort of torso. Virgo is your stomach. Libra is your I think, but Scorpio is your genitals, and so on. I won't go through the whole list, but anyways, now once you've done that, looked that up, I want you to back page a couple pages, go back to Google, take out the word man and put in the word horse. Aaron is
as
doing
you wish,
this.
Ma'am.
So we also got the zodiac horse. So also, you know, this
horoscopes.
So horse, you could also take your horse's horoscope to try to work out what ailments a sick horse might be suffering from. That one, yeah.
Oh my god.
So yeah, we also have like a horse with a scorpion in between its hind legs.
Seems uncomfortable and dangerous.
And a sheep on its head, and so on. And a lot of this also tied into humor theory. So the medieval medical theory, well, believed in the Middle Ages, again, not developed in the Middle Ages, not constricted to the Middle Ages, but the belief that a lot of health had to do with different fluids in your body and how well those were balanced. So, for instance, one of the horse recommendations was, since Taurus, I believe, governs like the shoulders, don't let blood from your horse's shoulders during the season of Taurus. So, yeah, there you go. Medieval veterinary advice for horses based on the zodiac.
Why don't they put this in the metro? I don't understand.
But again, this is really complicated stuff, and it goes far beyond the modern sort of, oh, what star sign are you? And it basically ends there, because you have the zodiac signs, so there's also the 12 houses, and so you have planets that move through these 12 houses, these different sectors of the sky, and so the conjunctions of different star signs and planets with each other can basically create what are seen as, you know, extremely cosmically powerful times to do certain mm-hmm. things, or extremely cosmically dangerous times.
Coming back to the metaphor of the universe as this kind of gigantic clockwork mechanism, you can imagine the universe as this, like, again, you're inside this gigantic machine.
Yeah. For instance, like you had this idea that... Saturn... in particular, as a planet, was related to poisonings and sort of impure substances in your body, or that the planet Mercury is related to insanity. So, for instance, like if you're a Leo Or if you're an Aries, and Mercury is in the house of Aries, which is also the medical sign associated with the head, then you're probably absolutely going to go insane, because that's like a triple, you know, it's your sign, it's in that sign, and it's also like the planet associated with insanity.
Awesome, I look forward to that.
So you probably go werewolf mode.
Oh, hell yeah.
You had these incredibly complex representations of the movements of the planets and the stars, because that was extremely important for determining what types of medical treatments should be administered. And yeah, we've also got like great descriptions of what sorts of medical ailments each signs are most susceptible to.
Oh yeah, what do we need to be worried about, you and me?
So for me, it says that there's a tendency to digestive upset from nervous causes, producing acidity and other trouble. That's actually not true. I have like an iron stomach.
So basically it's like the stars are going to, the cosmos is going to give you acid reflux.
Yeah. For Leo, it says nearly all afflictions tend to arise from overexertion of some kind.
Definitely not true.
No, you seem quite, you're quite robust actually.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, there were whole sort of arrays of things that were associated, cures and treatments that were associated with these signs as well. So like, for instance, Mercury is associated with wildflowers and hazelnuts. So when Mercury is in Scorpio, it might be a good time to treat STDs with hazelnuts or something. I mean, again, it's very complicated, but it all has to do with these conjunctions and layers and layers.
So whilst the official position of the church was probably like, okay, I guess astrology's fine, but just like, don't get too into it. Like, and don't try and use it to predict politics. We know from one particular astrologer's notebook that people definitely did use astrology to try and predict the future. So we know this from the notebook of the astrologer Richard Trevithan, who worked in the 15th century, and he was commissioned by a lot of clients to produce a lot of predictions, right, about a lot of different things. And I'm going to talk about some of the different kinds of predictions that he was asked to make. There are a lot of his predictions concern sex and sexuality. So I'm going to read some. Pregnant women and boys will incur harm and severe dangers. This conclusion is drawn from the trine aspect between Saturn and Venus on the day of ingress. There will be many acts of fornication and much love between men and women in secret and against the law. And so there's a lot of that. There's also quite a lot of politics, because using astrology to predict politics is drawn from the same emotional place and about as useful as looking at polls and polling averages. It's like going to, this is the equivalent of going to 538 every week in an election year.
Nathaniel Argentum.
Concerning the wars of this year, they will be caused by the aspect of opposition of two heavy planets, which will occur on the 27th of March. Much blood will flow. The western part will fare much better than the east. Evil people will dominate the good. These conclusions are from Saturn in Scorpio.
There you go. It's all about the planet in Zodiac.
Many such cases. So there's a lot of stuff about also, like, just domestic issues. So, like, will my husband come back? my shithead husband ran out. Is he coming back? Or, like, my son is missing. When asked by one woman whether or not her husband, who basically stormed out in anger, will come back to her, he said, "The person will return because Venus in the ascendant means that the woman will be agreeable."
Hope you guys are taking notes.
There's also quite a lot about, like, crime solving. So the abbot of Baim commissions him to develop a description of a thief. "He is of ruddy complexion, with greasy brown hair, and often has red pimples on his face. He has a scanty beard and small eyes. His body is coarse and crooked. He is a sower of weeds and discord between men." Not a very, it's like, damn, tell us how you really feel.
Yeah.
But a lot of his predictions were actually commercial. So a lot of business people would come to him to get business advice about what's going to happen in the business sphere. It's like reading Bloomberg. Wow. So that gives us quotes like, lawsuits in general will progress, and they will be lawful and beneficial. Likewise, there will be few pleadings and words among men. Or, provisions will be good, and there will be profit from a journey.
If the sun is in Taurus, that means we should be bullish on the stock market.
Boom.
Yeah.
Well, we've come back from space. What have we learned?
I think to describe a lot of the astronomical and scientific inquiries in the Middle Ages as ahead of their time, I think is not fair. They were of their time. And there's a reason why, for instance, Robert Grosseteste is not remembered as, you know, a scientific great on the level of Isaac Newton or Kepler, for instance.
Kepler himself, by the way, big on the music of the spheres.
Very big on the music of the spheres. But at the same time, I think we do have to acknowledge that there is a debt that Western science owes to these men of the Middle Ages. It was mostly men, sorry. Because they were, again, asking the same questions that we have been asking for centuries and that we're still asking today. These existential questions that maybe don't relate to what I'm doing right now or what I should do when I wake up tomorrow, but relate to my place in the universe and my place in a world that is much, much bigger and more complicated than perhaps I can really understand. It is trying to understand the ununderstandable, and I can understand why people have been doing that for so long.
There is something about space that's really freaky. I remember before manned space travel was a thing, in the US there was a lot of anxiety in NASA about the concept of space madness. That just like you get up there and you just start wigging out immediately because it would be that freaky. Now that term is no longer in use because, I mean, we've done it at this point. It's pretty routine.
Yeah.
Like, if even Elon Musk can get one of those things up in the air, it's no longer novel. But I do think there's something there that like the vastness and potential infiniteness of the cosmos is pretty terrifying. And you find yourself asking many, like you say, many of the same questions that we ask today. I think what I'm driving at is the fact that space and the cosmos and the universe for medieval people is a very tactile, tangible, real thing. It's not just like a bunch of weird lights in the sky. It is a place that exists physically. And you probably can't go there unless you're in a magical boat or you're Dante and it's a big metaphor about people you don't like. And I think that there is a strong desire to apply a form of rationality to that. It's just that they ended up through different assumptions and different technological processes that limited what they could observe. They ended up with a universe that, like our universe, is rational, but is a very, very different beast. It is, I would return to, the idea that we are living in a giant machine. And it's this big clock that just occasionally blasts you with like radiation that makes you insane.
Okay, this was a phrase that was used by medieval astronomers, the world machine. And I think yeah, or maybe our conceptions are not so different, especially when you remain within the observable world, the world that was observable to them. The idea that we live in a sort of set of concentric rings that are traversed by the planets and the cosmic bodies is not that far off. It's pretty understandable how they could have gotten to that point. And I think what the big difference really is the sense of purpose and the sense of divine sort of placement of all of these things. Because Robert Grosseteste warned about the idea of infinity and grappling, thinking that you as a human could grapple with the idea of infinity and with the notion of conceiving of a space and then a space beyond that and beyond that and beyond that and so on. And so I do think that sort of finite worldview was really crucial to the medieval, to the medieval mind, because it is true that if you step out beyond our spheres, beyond the planets in our solar system, it does start to look a lot less neat and tidy, and we start to see ourselves sort of floating about in this cosmic soup that is chaotic and hectic and vast and does not feel very divinely placed.
No, but I do think that there is something comforting about the model of the universe that medieval people constructed, because at the end of the finite universe, there is God. At the end of our finite universe, who knows what's out there? It's a whole lot of big, yawning, screaming nothing. And that is a lot scarier. Well, that's just about going to do it for another episode of the Weird But Evil Guys podcast. Thank you for listening as we journeyed across the universe on our cosmic psychedelic voyage to a place beyond time. And if you liked this episode and this show, then please do leave us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Tell a friend, recommend it to people. Recommend it to people who you think would like it. Recommend it to people who you don't think would like it, but you want to make them suffer.
Yeah.
And most importantly, if you leave a comment on Spotify, we might read it out like Olivia's about to do now.
Ooh, okay. Thank you to Bia, who said, I never met Bonnie, and I love Bonnie too. You're right. You do love Bonnie. Everybody loves Bonnie.
I'm having a lot of good Bonnie time this week. It's been a Bonnie-heavy week for us. So everybody else can just live in seething jealousy.
And thank you as well to Sabrina Meyer, who said on our Medieval Textiles episode, wife of Bath be like, no females born after 1293 can wife. All they know is romance of the rose, be bisexual, spin wool, and lie. I don't know if you saw that one before, Aaron.
No, I didn't.
That was a really good one. Thank you.
And that will be the only joke about bisexual women that will appear in this episode about astrology.
That's after I do some judicious editing.
Well, Olivia, where can people find you?
I don't know. I don't find me. Find yourself.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a transitional moment for us.
Yeah.
In terms of social media.
But
platforms.
Do join the Discord.
Yes.
We'll link that.
Yes, we will link, as always, we'll link below the link to the Weird Medieval Guys official Discord. It's a chill place where people talk about history and art and culture. And are just generally very nice, which is rare on the internet.
Yeah, join us.
We barely have to do any moderation whatsoever because people don't take the piss. Join our cult.
And we'll see you next time. Toodaloo.
Take it easy.
A couple more, we can find it.
Yeah, you're right.
That's my favorite Beatles album, Crossbow.
And Legionnaire Paprikum's Lonely Hearts Guild Band back in the Holy Roman Empire. Yeah. Back in Agrigentum.
Okay. Now I want to write that entire song. Drive my chariot across the universe. There we go. Full circle.
Woohoo. Wow. Full
across
spherical.
The spheres.
Yes. Okay.
Get in the TARDIS, Ringo.